Gospel according to Luke, the fifth chapter. One day Jesus was standing by the lake of Gennesaret. The people were crowding around him and listening to the word of God. He saw at the water's edge two boats left there by the fishermen who were washing their nets. He got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, and asked him to put out a little from the shore. Then he sat down and taught the people. When he finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into deep water and let down the nets for a catch." Simon answered, "Master, we've worked hard all night and haven't caught anything, but because you say so, I will let down the nets." When they had done so, they caught such a large number of fish that their nets began to break. So they signaled their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And when they came and filled the boats so full that they began to sink. When Simon Peter saw this, he fell at Jesus' knees and said, "Go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man." For he and all his companions were astonished at the catch of fish they had taken. And so were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, Simon's partners. Then Jesus said to Simon, "Don't be afraid. From now on you will fish for people." So they pulled up their boats on shore, left everything, and followed him. The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, O Christ.
Please be seated. And now, God, may the words which I speak, the thoughts we think together, and the actions that we would take as a result be acceptable and pleasing in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. One summer, when I was in college, I had one of those truly crummy jobs that every young person desperately needs to have early in life. Young people need to have that miserable job, not only to motivate them to buckle down and earn that certification or degree, but also so that years later, when they are deeply into their chosen profession and have a bad day at work, they can rub their temples, lean back in their chair, take a deep breath, and say, "Well, at least this beats that horrible summer before my junior year." Well, one of the crummy jobs that I had before my junior year was to drive around the city delivering dinner club memberships to those who had fallen for the cold call pitch of the telemarketer who had randomly called them a few days before. It was not a glamorous job. And it was made more difficult by the fact that sometimes people would change their minds by the time I had arrived to deliver the membership and collect payment. Even more frustrating, sometimes people would explain that they had not agreed to purchase the membership at all. And after that happened a few times too many, I verbalized my vexation to my supervisor. He scratched his head, and then he confessed that a few of the telemarketers that he had hired that summer would regularly come to work under the influence of a mood-altering substance and probably had absolutely no comprehension whatsoever of any conversation they had had the entire previous day, let alone during their work shift. Well, needless to say, this was difficult for a sweet, somewhat naive, sheltered little Cedarville college student to understand. But one day, while making those deliveries, I had a memorable experience. It was like one of those movies where a divine messenger played by Morgan Freeman comes on scene to tell the main character the exact next right move in his or her life. I can see this man vividly in my mind's eye to this day. He took the time to ask where I was going to school, what I was studying, how I intended to pay for it. And I explained that I was working two jobs that summer, that I ordinarily worked during the school year, that I was studying at a small private Christian college, pursuing a degree comprised of courses in history and psychology, religion, and Greek. in order to prepare myself for seminary. He asked if I anticipated having any student loan debt when I graduated, and I confessed that I probably would. And then he said, "Son, you can get everything you need to prepare yourself for seminary for much less money if you transfer to an in-state public school. Why don't you transfer to..." And then he mentioned a school that was about 3 hours down the road. Well, of course, I immediately dismissed his suggestion. I thought of my friends at college and my wonderful Christian professors. Now, fast forward 20 years from that conversation. By that time, 20 years later, I'd lost touch with all of my friends from college. And I happened to have become a pastor of a church in that very town where that university that man told me about was located. And I soon discovered that one member of my church, a wonderful Christian man, had been a professor of church history at that university during my college years. Another member, another truly wonderful Christian man, had been a professor of psychology at the university during my college years. In fact, he had developed a family systems model that countless Christian counselors use to this day in their daily practice. Reflecting on the years that it took me to pay off my college loans and raise money for seminary, I scratched my head and thought, maybe I should have considered that man's advice more carefully. Now, I tell you that story because Peter, at the beginning of our gospel text, was a lot like me that summer before my junior year of college. A young man who had plotted out the course of his life and was hard at work to make it happen in the way that he intended, thinking he knew exactly how it would play out. Peter was a man whose life was well underway. We know that he was already married by this time. Earlier in Luke's gospel, we're told that he had a mother-in-law who Jesus had healed. And we can derive from today's gospel lesson that he had begun a profitable business in a thriving village. We're told that he owns a boat, has obtained the necessary equipment, has business partners, and has established his business in a promising location, the village of Capernaum, on the shore of what Luke calls the Lake of Gennesaret, but which most of us would know as the Sea of Galilee. The lake had an ample supply of fish, and the village was located on a trade route, ensuring demand for what Peter and his partners could pull from the lake. One scholar I consulted said this: "We have a surprisingly good picture of the scale of Simon Peter and Andrew's fishing operation. They worked in partnership with James and John, the sons of Zebedee, who had employees themselves. They were free to start and stop work when it suited them. The impression that they were men of substance who controlled their own lives is confirmed by the quality of the house at Capernaum, a house which I know several of you have seen, known as the House of Peter since the 4th century. It is larger than most of the other houses excavated in Capernaum." Peter was a young man who had gotten started well in life and was likely thoroughly convinced that he had chosen the right path and that all would work out to his advantage, success, and gain. Except that one day, a divine character walked into his life and things would never be the same. We're told that Jesus was teaching by the lake and the crowds are so enthusiastic to hear his message that they press in upon him. The way that Luke tells us what happens next almost seems to imply that Jesus is being pushed back into the water by the crowd, and luckily he happens to spy out of the corner of his eye a few boats lying at the water's edge. When I read the story, I'm tempted to feel a little bit of relief that Jesus doesn't have to wade out into the water. But then I remind myself, wait a minute, this is Jesus. He could have just walked out onto the water 10 or 15 meters and really grabbed their attention. Instead, by asking Peter for the use of his boat, Jesus has clearly narrowed his intended audience from the crowd to just one man and his business partners. What Jesus had taught the crowd that day has not even been recorded for us, at least in this particular text. That's because what he said to the crowd is far less important than what he said to Peter. You see, Jesus' words are not just pithy maxims for the world at large. They're meant to be personally internalized. They're meant to be ingested, digested, and manifested by each one of us. We know that by the time of the events recorded in today's gospel lesson, that Peter had already had some familiarity with Jesus. In the previous chapter, Peter witnessed Jesus' power to cast out a demon and to heal his mother-in-law. In Luke chapters 4 and 5, we see Peter giving Jesus more and more of what I would call initial access into his life. After listening to Jesus teach in the synagogue, he welcomes him into his home. He sees him heal his mother-in-law, and now in our gospel text, he accepts Jesus' request to use his boat as a platform from which to teach the crowd. And then Jesus gives Peter what must have seemed to this seasoned fisherman to be a completely absurd instruction. As Peter was packing up his equipment and ready to call it a day, Jesus tells Peter to put out into deep water. But I don't think Jesus is merely telling Peter where to locate his boat. He's foreshadowing what their relationship will become, and he's telegraphing to us what discipleship looks like. Throughout the Gospel of Luke and into the book of Acts, Jesus increasingly calls Peter to trust him, even when it means getting in over his head and doing things that seem to make absolutely no sense whatsoever. In this text, Peter serves as a model of what it means to appropriately respond to the presence of Jesus in our lives. And Peter gives as much as he knows of himself to as much as he knows of Jesus. And we're called to do likewise. Jesus comes to Peter in the course of his daily routine, and it hasn't been a good day. The previous night has been full of fruitless toil. But Jesus invites Peter to put out into deeper water and cast his nets again. Now, this is nonsense, and let me tell you why. Scholars tell us that the nets that were being used were likely trammel nets. They required 2 to 4 men to deploy them, and they needed washing every morning. They were made of linen, used only at night because they would be visible to the fish during the day. It's already the end of Peter's workday. If he follows Jesus' instructions, he's likely not to catch anything, and he will only have to repeat the washing of the nets. But because of what he already knows of Jesus, he takes another step of trust. Notice that Peter addresses Jesus in verse 5 as Master. Peter, in effect, is transferring authority over the boat to Jesus. He's saying, "Jesus, take the wheel." Now, of course, Jesus wants authority over much more than just the boat. He wants to take up his rightful place of authority over all of Peter's life. But he will do so one lesson at a time, one day at a time, one insight at a time, one prayer at a time, just as he does in your life, just as he does in mine. The next phase of the lesson that day teaches Peter about what Jesus is able to do and who Peter himself is. Through the miraculous catch of fish, Jesus demonstrates that he can provide for all of Peter's needs in embarrassing abundance. After all, this seasoned fisherman starts to look pretty foolish when not only his own boat, but also that of his business partner is about to go under. But oddly, neither the threat of embarrassment nor of losing his boat, nor even the peril of drowning is at the top of mind for Peter in that moment. He doesn't cry out, "Lord, what have you done? I followed you out to this deep water, I listened to your absurd obstruction, and now look where it's gotten me." Instead, he demonstrates his own self-awareness in light of who he is coming to understand Jesus to be. Up to this moment, Jesus has been merely a wise teacher and a powerful wonder worker to Peter. But with his life on the line, Peter realizes that Jesus is a holy man of God. It's too much to say at this point that he fully grasped that Jesus is the Messiah, the incarnate second person of the Trinity, but Peter knows that Jesus is God's divine agent, that he is in the presence of greatness and holiness and awesomeness. And so he responds in the same way that Isaiah the prophet responded to the greatness and holiness of God in our Old Testament lesson. He cries out in fear and awareness of his sinful state, falling on his knees and crying out, "Go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man." The result of God's presence is not enhancement or endorsement, but exposure. It strikes me how little we are like Peter in this moment. We tend to be so much more like the people to whom the Apostle Paul wrote the letter in our New Testament lesson today, those at the church in Corinth, those proud in their gifts and their accomplishments and their self-sufficiency, having only the vaguest sense of our perilous condition before a holy God, and all too often viewing our faith as a nice-to-have, ancillary concern, much like an ample spare bedroom on a well-appointed house. Peter rightly understood the situation and made no attempt to domesticate Jesus. But how does our response to Jesus line up? Each day, are you giving more and more of what you know of yourself to more and more of what you know of Jesus? To invert a current theological label, that is what genuine progressive Christianity truly is. Peter follows Jesus' instruction even when it seems absurd, and doing so puts his life at risk. Ultimately, it will cost his life, because as Bonhoeffer said, when Jesus calls a man, he calls him to come and die. He calls him to die to the old so that he might live to the new. It's hairy, scary stuff. So Jesus immediately says to Peter and to us, "Stop being afraid. From now on, you will fish for people." Jesus has met Peter in the course of his ordinary routine. He could have never guessed that letting Jesus climb into his boat that day would have such extraordinary consequences. But a genuine meeting with Jesus completely alters one's perspective and ultimately the course of one's life. And that can be hairy, scary stuff. Perhaps today, you sense that Jesus is desiring to climb into your boat. And you sense your unworthiness. You feel a bit of discomfort and anxiety at his presence. You fear that he might know you a bit better than you would like. Perhaps like Peter, you wish he would just go away and let you get back to your routine. But Jesus says to you, and he says to me, "Stop being afraid to trust. I'm going to do something you never could have imagined in you and through you." After all, at the end of the day, this thing that we call Christian faith comes down to simply knowing and being known. Now, if that sounds like I've hung out in Asheville, North Carolina, or Yellow Springs, Ohio, a bit too much lately, consider Jesus' teaching in Matthew chapter 7. He says, "In the day of judgment, many will recount all of the great things that they had done for Jesus. But Jesus will respond, 'Depart from me, I never knew you.'" So let's get to know him. Let's give as much as we know of ourselves to as much as we know of him, and tomorrow, let's give a bit more. And by doing so, we will invite others to know him as well. Bishop N.T. Wright captures all we've been saying this morning this way. He says this: "In your mind, become Peter for a few minutes. Pause and ponder what you normally do, day after day. And then imagine Jesus suddenly appearing, asking for your help in his own work, and then telling you to do something in your own line of work which seems completely pointless, an entire waste of time and effort. You do it, grumbling perhaps under your breath, and suddenly everything clicks into place. Everything succeeds on a scale you'd never dreamed of. What's going on? How did it happen? Feel the sense of awe, terror even, as you come to terms with the power of Jesus, then feel that sense of terror increase as he turns to you with what looks like a question in his eyes, though it proves to be a command. "You and I are going to be working together from now on," he says. And you realize you have no choice. If this man isn't worth following, nobody is. Amen.